Yeah, hi. I confess I haven't heard this podcast before, and I'm basically here because you promised me I'd be allowed to talk about Dizzy. But, of course, I don't know anything about the Berenstain Bears. Like, I don't know if they were even available here in the UK. I certainly didn't encounter them if they were. I only know about them from internet memes.
That's fine, because in this episode, we're not actually going to discuss much about the Berenstain Bears.
Well, don't say that. Your Berenstain loyal fans might switch straight off. How about we promise to mention the Berenstain Bears at some point during this so that everyone's kept on the hook?
I will make that promise, and I will say it is amazing to talk to someone who doesn't have any preconceived notions about the Berenstain Bears, because it means that you're pronouncing the name correctly.
Well, no, that's my one preconceived notion. It was when the whole Mandela effect thing kicked off by everyone going, wait a minute, it's Berenstain Bears?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. That was when I heard about, that's basically when I heard of the Berenstain Bears. Oh no, but there was, I think there was a Something Awful thread before that where people were photoshopping covers.
Oh, yes. Yes, there definitely was. And I still get sent those every few months. Someone's like, have you ever seen these? I'm like, oh, I sure have seen that.
Yeah. Well, I think that was when I first heard of the Berenstain Bears.
Well, my audience has no idea what's going on right now.
That's right. So absolutely, everyone whose ears receive the sounds you're currently making doesn't know what you're on about except you.
I'm going to introduce the show, and then I'm going to bring you in, and we'll do big hellos.
Right. Oh, we haven't started.
Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I'm your host, Phil Gonzalez, and this week we are continuing not talking about the Berenstain Bears, but instead talking to creators who are doing something similar to what I'm doing, which is exploring the popular culture that they grew up with. And not only that they grew up with, but that kind of shaped a little bit of their outlook, shaped the way they create today, shaped the way they interact with people online, but from a perspective that is not, oh, look at this dumb thing I grew up with, but more, look at how what I grew up with and what I loved as a child sort of informed the way, still informed the way I look at popular culture today. And to do that, I have brought on a guest. You may know him from his YouTube channel, Demon Tomato Dave, where he has posted videos about it's hard to explain. If you didn't grow up in the 80s, you don't know what it was like to have discovered video games and computer games in the 80s. But he has a video called Dave's First Game, which, if you have not watched it, is vital to understanding what it was like to be alive as a child while an entire style of entertainment was being born. You may know him from his podcast, Sonic the Comic, the podcast, which he is one of the co-hosts of. You may know him from his podcast, Serious Disney, which he is one of the co-hosts of. You may know him from his cartoons. You may know him from his music. I don't know what you know him from, but you should know him. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Dave Ballmer. Hello, Dave.
Hello. That was a very glowing review. Thank you for that. And and I'm here to talk about Muzzy in Gondoland.
Good, because I've got so much to ask.
Well, ask away. I can't answer any questions.
So, usually I talk about the Berenstain Bears, yeah. But I am just fascinated by content creators, people who spend their time talking about the popular culture from their childhood, not from a, as I put it on my show, not from a look at this dumb thing perspective, but from a, wow, look at this just almost obscure material that I didn't even realize as it was happening, but it just kind of shaped the person I am today. And you explore that in Sonic the Comic, the podcast, you explore it in Serious Disney, you explore it online. And I really want to talk about the joy of exploring that part of your life.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is something that I do, really, isn't it? I think most of the things I do are, I've never really put it together, but I think everything that I do across any medium can be described in the terms you just said, because I guess one of my superpowers is that I can just remember my childhood very well. And mm-hmm. I know that, you know, there is a huge chunk of the internet that's dedicated to remembering your childhood, but usually that's done in terms of, like, knowing the facts about something that was on TV because you've since, you know, got the DVD or you know, filled out a Wikipedia entry or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm more about the sense of what it was like to be there and what these things felt like or meant at the time with the correct context. And I try to put across what that is. So, like, everyone knows what the Ninja Turtles is, and everyone, you know, knows what the 80s series was like, whether they remember it or not, just because there's information everywhere and jokes about it. But there's not enough people who talk about how important it was to, for instance, like, have the transfers, like the temporary skin tattoos, or to have read the 1989 or whatever it was Turtles annual. That uh-huh. sort of thing can't really be recreated by going, oh, I'm going to go and find out about Turtles. You have to talk to someone who was there. And that, I haven't tackled that one, but I will one day. And at the moment, yes, I'm in the middle of a very big project of doing that for Sonic the Hedgehog as it first appeared in, you know, 1990 and onwards.
And for many of my listeners, they don't realize that if they're not from the UK, they might not realize that the way Sonic the Hedgehog appeared in the UK was a very different experience to how it appeared in America.
Yeah, that's right. It was the marketing was run by a different company. It was a completely different approach, and it was better. well, I actually feel fairly comfortable saying that, because even though, you know, of course, you know, my nostalgia is better than your nostalgia, there'll always be a hint of that in your own heart. But here, Sonic won the console war, and in America he didn't. And that, I think, does speak to the approach that they went with. Because here in the UK, Sonic was given a series of novels before almost anything else. You know, before America's comics began, for instance, before there was a cartoon series, we had these Sonic novels. There were sort of adventure game books around the same time. And of course, around about the same time the American comic started, we had a comic as well. The difference being that the American comic was sort of, well, it was made by Archie, and Archie Comics is a, you know, essentially they just made Archie Comics, but starring Sonic instead of Archie. So it was about sort of, you know, a mix between a kind of 1950s style, half cartoon, half sitcom style humor, and teen drama, like teen mm-hmm. relationship melodrama and stuff. And depending on what era you were reading it in, that was what it was. Now, towards the end of its run, it suddenly swerved and became good because, you know, fans from my generation took over. But right. and that's finished now. But at the same time as that started, instead of that, instead of this odd sort of slapstick comedy thing based on the design documents of a TV series that had already moved beyond those design documents by the time it launched, here in the UK, our Sonic comic that started at the same time was more like a sort of a semi-games magazine that had 7 pages in it of Sonic comic, but also it had other comics in it, like Golden Axe and Shinobi and Wonder Boy and Streets of Rage and all sorts of, like, all the other Sega games of the time got strips inside this sort of bumper magazine that also had, like, games news and reviews and things. And it was just an altogether different approach. But as a result, it forms this kind of portal into 1993 life if you were, you know, let's say 7 to 12 years old. And that is why we make Sonic the Comic, the podcast. We are looking at that, and we, you know, we read out the adverts and the letters page and the reviews because we're trying to get a sense of what was going on in the world across to listeners. And I, you know, wherever I possibly can, I'll edit in the adverts, the audio from them and so on, you know, TV adverts and like, because that is what I'm interested in. And as it turns out, so is my co-host friend Chris, who McFeely, who we just had the same idea that we wanted to transport people to that time. And yeah, that seems to be something like what you're doing, and it certainly goes across most of the things that I create, certainly.
Now, I assume, and I don't know exactly, but you, I think you're slightly younger than me.
No idea.
Because I am 43.
Oh, yeah, slightly, yeah, I'm 38.
And there you go. And so our, you know, like the age you were at that time, down to the like the year, even maybe even the half year difference, affects the way popular culture came to you and the way you digested it. Because I think of myself, I was a child of the 80s strictly, because by the time the 90s rolled around, I was in high school and had different concerns with theater, drama, doing musicals.
Yes, I do have a lot of strong memories of the 80s, like a lot of the 80s, certainly the second half of them. But, of course, those memories come from a different perspective because I was a small child. I was at primary school and I was, you know, when... I would say that when Turtles started, that was my last chance to have a proper, I am a small child kind of a craze happen to me. By the time Sonic really kicked in, I was approaching my teen years, which is why I can remember everything, every detail about what that was like. That's interesting. It's nice to talk to someone your age, because up until shortly ago, I'm in a funny age bracket in between, because see, you're old enough to remember the Star Wars is coming out, right? Or at least the last one.
I'm old enough to remember being 2 years old and crying because my aunt asked if I wanted to go see Star Wars. And all I knew about Star Wars was my sister's Star Wars bed sheets that had a Chewbacca on them and how scared I was of this giant dog man. And so in my head, as a two-year-old, I was freaked out at the notion of having to go see a movie with this giant dog man in it. And I remember the crying because we were on a soccer pitch, because my sister played soccer, and someone took a photo of me crying on my mom's shoulder. And for years, I would see this photo and be like, that's the exact moment someone asked me if I wanted to go see Star Wars, and I was terrified of Chewbacca. But it resonates with me because as kids, especially in the 80s and the 90s, we were only allowed our window into popular culture was only what was given to us.
Yes.
We couldn't go to online and explore and see what things were. So we only knew this narrow feed. Yeah. And for a kid, it was my sister's Chewbacca bedsheets.
Yeah. Now I was the oldest sibling. So, I don't have, like my wife, for example, she has a brother who's some years older than she is, and so he would pass down things like Star Wars to her. But I didn't have that, so yeah, I was all about the things that were happening at the time. I only vaguely cared about Star Wars at all, and that was because they were cartoons based on it on TV at the time. So like, I don't care about Star Wars, but I do care about R2-D2, you know, things like that.
And that is a totally valid valid opinion to have, especially in this day and age. We've kind of looped back around again.
But yeah, it's always been interesting to me because I think I come from a sort of in-betweeny kind of age group, which is that up until a few years ago, the internet culture was run by people a bit older than me, and I guess then a bit older than you, because it was about Star Wars and it was about, you know, sort of the things that happened between about 1977 and about 1984. The stuff that came out then was like the main stuff that people were being nostalgic about. And then very suddenly I've skimmed through to where I'm now too old for internet culture again, and anything I remember is now sort of the equivalent of, you know, parents talking about the Beatles or whatever. It's like
exactly
old stuff, and I don't remember ever quite finding myself in a time where my stuff was exactly now, like, or where like my nostalgia was exactly the one that people cared about. But part of that could be because mine comes from the UK, so my video game nostalgia, for instance, is based on, you know, over in America famously there was a video game Crash, and in the UK there wasn't, because we didn't really care about games consoles from Atari. We cared about playing our games on computers, and those never went away. So, you know, we sailed smoothly through without noticing there was any sort of video game crash, and as a result, didn't really care about the Nintendo Entertainment System as much. We did care, and I was a very, you know, extremely passionate fan of the NES, but only in 1992 or 3, like later on. It didn't actually matter at the time. So, yeah, things things are skewed a little bit differently. And I think part of what I'm doing with Sonic the Comic the Podcast and some of my other stuff is, I don't know, just essentially planting my flag as well and going, like, well, here's the stuff that doesn't get talked about, because our stuff kind of gets overlooked as being simultaneously something for the little kids, not as interesting as Star Wars, and also something that whose time has completely passed because it isn't, I don't know, Paw Patrol.
Well, it was really driven home to me the differences of this popular culture. It was actually on Twitter. Mm. You and I had an exchange about the Bumblebee Man from,
yes, right,
from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And I pointed out that the Bumblebee Man was actually based on an actual character from Mexican television,
yeah,
which I grew up with because I grew up in Texas,
right,
and I'm, you know, half my family is Mexican. So when I would go over to my grandparents' house, that's the channel that would be on, and there would always be comedies that I didn't understand as a kid, but that featured this guy dressed up as a giant insect, or a guy dressed up as a giant baby, or scantily clad women playing school children. I could never really quite understand what it was, but it was a style of humor I didn't understand. And it was only as I got older that I realized that what we consider global culture is very limited, and yeah, children's entertainment especially is so hyper-localized, especially from like the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, before the internet started making everything more accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
That, and then, of course, American popular culture kind of planted its flag and was like, we're what you should be remembering. That you will mention things on Sonic the Comic, the podcast, that are just, I have never heard of in my entire life.
Yeah, you will never have seen an episode of The Big Breakfast with Chris Evans, for instance.
Nope. I only know of it because you guys mention it.
Yes. What I like to do is try and put as much of that stuff in, but also explain what it was to a certain degree, to whatever degree I can, to contextualize it in the moment, you know.
Right.
Yeah, because otherwise we're all just talking nonsense. And essentially, I'm trying to provide that service in a way, because I've been so frustrated over the years with people online doing pop culture references that mean nothing, but without that extra cushion of like, oh, and here's what it was. I mean, one of the most frustrating experiences for me has been watching, or trying to watch, Mystery Science Theater, because, you know, half the jokes in that are just, they'll just literally say a name of a character on a TV show that something happening on screen right now reminds them of. Like this, I think it's the Space Mutiny episode. There's a guy on it called Captain Calgon or something like that. His name's Calgon anyway. And they, you know, they all fall about laughing and they do references to Calgon, which is a thing.
Uh-huh.
But not only do we not have the thing that they're referencing, we had a different thing called Calgon. Which cleans washing machines. Washing machines live longer with Calgon was the slogan. And so there's so many positions removed from that joke that I, you know, a British person watching Mystery Science Theater has to essentially like puzzle out what all the jokes were and just sort of pretend we get, like, just, you know, go like, ah, I understand the sort of general gist of that joke, rather than actually finding it funny.
On even that reference, because I grew up, you know, I watched Mystery Science Theater growing up in Texas. Now I live in Minnesota, which is where Mystery Science Theater was, of course, created. And like the studios were just like down the road. And not realizing until I moved here how many of the jokes were hyper-local.
Oh, right.
When they would reference Maplewood, there's a joke in one of the episodes where some of the characters are walking down this kind of just like cruddy backlot street, yeah, like strip, and there's like a storefront with like just junk in it, and one of the bots said, "Ah, Fredericks of Maplewood," which is a Fredericks of Hollywood joke, because Fredericks of Hollywood is of course a sexy lingerie store, but Maplewood is a suburb of the Twin Cities.
Okay, and that's exactly the sort of joke I was talking about. Yeah, there's no way I could have understood any of that. I haven't.
There's no way a person who didn't live in the Twin Cities could have understood that.
Well, that bit, but also I've never heard of the lingerie shop or whatever it was you just said. So like,
oh, yeah,
that no part of that made any sense. So I would have just assumed that they're saying something Americans would understand, but it turns out you have to even live in their neighborhood to get it, which actually makes me like it more.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, I do. One of the things I really do miss, really, truly, really miss, is that sense of place that we all used to have. The internet has opened things up, and it's maybe this feels the same everywhere. I've always felt that in the UK, it's a bit more frustrating because what the internet has done is essentially said, like, well, mainstream American culture is now the main thing, and if you're mm-hmm. a satellite outside of that, if you live in Minnesota or whatever, you're going to have to just like read around that, and we'll do the general jokes. But those of us out in the UK, you know, can't even understand a word of it. Well, now I realize it's perhaps more specific than that, but certainly it used to be that. Okay, this is difficult for me to explain, as you can tell, but that effect, the effect the internet has had, has spread out so that places where you used to be able to get very place-specific, references mm-hmm. found, now don't do it anymore. So when I was growing up, for instance, there were 4 TV channels in the UK, terrestrial TV channels, and that was it. Very rich people and retired people did sometimes have more channels than that, but yeah. generally speaking, there were just the 4, and that's what everybody had. So everyone had the same references in that sense. But each region of the UK, which is, you know, about the size of a US state or smaller, depending on the state,
yeah.
you know, had their own local TV stations on those 4. So, like, the 3rd mm-hmm. and 4th channel had regional versions of those channels. There may even have been regional stuff on the 2 BBC channels, I can't remember. And, like, so you would hear, like, the adverts that would come on would be for shops that were within 20 minutes of where you lived.
Right.
But they had the polish of, they didn't look like local stuff at all. They looked, you know, it just all looked the same because there actually were quite big TV broadcasters in each region with the same kind of budget as each other. So, like, it did just feel like life happened around you and your culture was the culture, as it were. And now, even within those regions, there's a certain Americanism to it. That those sort of edges have been sanded off to the point where it's really strange for me to read Sonic the Comic now or watch, you know, kids' TV made in Britain from, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago or more. And people will say very, very local phrases or be very British in a way that now is rarer to find because they've got an eye towards selling the content to a wider audience as time goes on or putting it up on the internet for everybody to see and so on and so on. It's just something I'm interested in, and it is something that I lament. I'll go further. I'm not just talking about local TV and internet. And radio. Even the internet had local pockets back in the day. So, like, now, if there is a meme, that you can go to Know Your Meme and find it out, and it will have been something that's, you know, been showing up on Twitter, and it'll be on Reddit, and it'll be on all of the places. Well, when I started out on the internet, like, I still make references now. I can't help it. Part of my vocabulary is in jokes from the places I was on the internet. And I don't mean in a way that there's no equivalent to this that exists now. So anyone younger than me listening might not even be able to understand what I'm talking about. I don't mean the group that the in joke was from would be like fans of a particular thing or like the community for this or for that. It was like the particular chat room you happened to have found with the 10 people who frequented that place. There would be, you know, there would be email mailing lists and news groups and things where, you know, a maximum of sort of 50 people were subscribed to or ever went to. And each of them built up their own subcultures and their own jokes. And so I mentioned Something Awful earlier. That was probably the biggest and the last of those places because that was insular in that you had to actually pay to join. And very ban happy. So if you know, they and quite reasonably and quite rightly, there is a bad reputation for some of the stuff that went on at Something Awful back in those days, and that's not wrong. But also, some of the best internet stuff came from there because they were essentially curating content and making sure that there was a certain level of quality, or you did get banned. And of course, you know, where that threshold was changed as the people in charge of the ban
happened. Oh, of course.
But as a result of that, like, a load of in-jokes that went around there are still out there now. I'll tell you what, just recently I saw someone auction off, like, a pencil drawing that he did of just a man reclining in a chair holding a card and smoking a cigar or something, called Johnny Five Aces, I think it was called. And that was just a joke from... Well, no, I don't think it was a joke. It came from a thread. It was a sincere attempt at drawing the thing that people were talking about in the thread. But it was so sort of, you know, rubbish that, that it became absolutely beloved. And this ongoing in-joke, what we would now call a meme. And that's now sold for, like, over $5,000, even though it's just a scratchy pencil drawing that just sold the other day. And that's the sort of thing, I mean, it's jokes and references aren't as localized anymore, which means, of course, that, you know, more people can be in on it. But also, I wish people could know what the feeling is of being there and being privileged to be in the room when something like that starts.
Yeah,
and how funny it is when you see the next person post the same thing, because they're the first person who, you know, made that reference since the original thing happened, as it were. And, you know, that's something that's been lost to some degree. And the people making Mystery Science Theater will have felt that. And the people watching it in Minnesota will have felt it when that reference to that particular thing came up. Because it's like, yeah, that's my life. I know what that is.
Well, and it's when they revived Mystery Science Theater for Netflix, and they did a quality job at it. But when I watched it when it first came out, and I was like, oh, this isn't a Minnesota show anymore.
Right.
This is just a general comedy show now. It doesn't have the feel of a Minnesota show, which is very dry, there's a Minnesota style of humor that is very specific, and it's not a Wisconsin style of humor, and it's not a North Dakota style of humor, and it's certainly not Canadian. It's Minnesota, and when that was gone, I was like, well, it's still a funny show, but it's not the neighborhood show anymore.
Yeah.
Now, I promised you that you would be allowed to talk about Dizzy. And I know how important this is to you.
You almost got away with it. I had forgotten for a moment there.
but you talk a lot about Dizzy. A few years ago, you did a video called, was it Dave's First Game?
Yeah.
And a lot of that video focuses on that feeling of discovery, of... There is no context for what a child has said in front of them. It is...
Yes, exactly. To see games in those days when they were new, we look back at them now and we either go, ah, I recognize that that's what classic games used to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Or we go like, you know, oh, that looks really old. You know, a kid seeing one of those old games would probably go, wow, that looks awful because it looks so old. What I was trying to get across was how it was that... graphics that were awful, that, you know, mm-hmm. really were made out of sort of 100 pixels across a screen in these giant blocks, how it could be that we could become just as immersed in that and see that as just as real a world as a AAA game coming out today feels like. Because it did. And it controlled your mind in exactly the same way. And I want to make more of those videos. They're so hard to make, so I haven't made any more yet. But I've got the script for one all bashed out, and I've recorded a lot of it. So there is another one in the pipeline. But, like, I'm trying to get across how it felt to look at games in those days. Yeah,
I remember when Super Mario Brothers first came out, and I actually saw someone playing it at a Showbiz Pizza before I ever saw it on a home console.
My God. I'm going to talk about Showbiz Pizza in a minute. Go on.
it was the Nintendo, the Versus machines they had, where it was like the arcade version of Super Mario. But we were there for like a school event, like a, it's like pizza day for the school. And so like after school, we all went to Showbiz, and my I remember my friend Carrie was playing this video game, and people were like, you got to see this game. And we ran over to it. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is like playing a cartoon.
Yeah.
Graphics will never get better than this. I can't fathom how a computer game could look better than this, because this is exactly like playing a Saturday morning cartoon. And finally getting it on console and play, because I had the Nintendo Entertainment System before Super Mario was made available. Like,
what?
I had the version that came with the robot.
I don't think I've looked into this. I didn't know that that was a thing. I assumed it launched in America with it.
No, because when they first dropped it, they did it because of the game crash. They didn't want to sell a video game system, so they created the robot so they could sell it as a toy.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, I don't remember it, but I know it. Yeah.
So the Christmas that I got it, it had first dropped, and I got it, and it came with Gyromite, and it came with Duck Hunt,
right.
because it had the light gun, and so I had to buy Super Mario Brothers, and wow. I just remember sitting and playing this game and being like, I can't fathom how they did something so amazing, and I can't imagine where they could take it. And I tried to explain to my kids that like, every single time a video game would come out, it was the greatest thing that had ever been created, because we had nothing to compare it against.
Let me tell you about what it was like in the UK, and I think you'll appreciate this. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you've seen the graphics in my Dave's First Game video. You've seen that the ZX Spectrum did not do graphics as well as the NES did, but it was somewhere in that sort of wheelhouse. It was an old 8-bit style game.
Yeah.
And so there are comparisons to be made anyway. Things, you know, people could work to the system's strength in different ways. The difference was that when games came out on the ZX Spectrum, they were about £4.
Mm.
So whereas on the NES, you're looking at what? Somewhere in the range of between 40 and 50, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Dollars. Certainly, my memory of NES games is they were about £50.
Mm-hmm.
So of course that gave them a prestige, and that made each one slightly more precious.
Yeah.
But the ZX Spectrum had a kind of Steam sale feel to it. You could just hoover up games. You could have games without it, you know, without your parents objecting, without it breaking the bank. You could spend your own pocket money on games almost no matter how young you were. Although, unfortunately for me, I only actually realized this because I was no perfect child. You know, I was known at school for being quite badly behaved, but not in the way where I would, you know, kick anybody or whatever. I just couldn't stop talking and had a certain amount of disdain for certain tasks we were asked to do as part of our work. So for example, there was a whole term where whenever it was time for maths, instead of doing my maths, I was writing a book about it was called The Magic Tomato, which evolved into a comic series, The Demon Tomato. And that's why I'm called Demon Tomato Dave, because I'm the Dave that made that. But anyway, so that's the kind of kid I was. And before all that, for some reason, I never became the sort of kid who like pesters his parents into buying expensive things. I wasn't spoiled in that way, and I knew that I couldn't.
Yeah.
Not because, you know, I never felt deprived or anything like that. You know, it wasn't there was no strictness in our house, but just whatever deft bit of parenting they did, however it was they did it. As an example, I was a huge, huge, huge Turtles fan, and yet when mm-hmm. the Turtles movie came out, it literally didn't even occur to me to even ask to go and see that film. And we didn't. And eventually, you know, we got it on video, but that's the sort of thing. I wasn't the kind of kid who goes past something in the shop and goes, I want that, give me that, and I could expect to get it. So when it came to games, I only, you know, I had them very rarely, and only on my birthday or Christmas or whatever. But then one day, I remember the very day it happened, I remember the day that I realised, wait a minute, Spectrum games are £4. I can just buy them. Like, whenever I want. That, you know, like, I mean, I didn't, you know, and this is back in the days when, you know, pocket money was less than a pound for, you know, yeah, per week or whatever. So I'd still have to save up, but only to £4. Like, that's not much. Yeah. So I, and the day I realized this happened to be a day when we were on a trip, and I can't tell you if it was a school trip or I don't know what sort of trip it was, but we were on a trip to Stratford. Maybe it was just arranged between, like, a group of mums from the village. It was difficult. It was always difficult to tell because I was, because, you know, I grew up in this village where my mum knew all the other mums, and we, you know, so you would see the same kids at school and at church because my parents were Christian, and you know, a lot of the other parents in the area were. So we would see the same people at church. Yeah. And also just, you know, other circumstances as well. You'd always bump into the same people. Yeah. So this trip, I don't know whether it was a school trip, a church trip, or just a trip that mums arranged between us. But whatever it was, we were in Stratford, upon Avon, the Shakespeare town where Shakespeare lived and worked.
Yes.
And did he work there? Anyway, that's where we were. And it's all Shakespeare-y there. And we were going to Shakespeare exhibits and things, and it was a very blazing hot day. We went to this big park they have there, huge park with loads of people out sunbathing. It was a bit like when the when the beaches are overly packed with people sunbathing. It was too packed. There was swans everywhere. There was I remember seeing my very first strawberry flavor Calippo ice lolly there. It was lovely. Oh. Lovely day. And while we were there, I just remember realizing that I today could buy a game and go home from today with a new game. And sure enough, so me and my friend went into what must have been a WH Smith or something, a sort of place where you could buy that sort of thing. That was a shop we had in the UK where you could buy that games. And I was looking at the games and I didn't find one for the price that I wanted. I knew what I was looking for. I was looking for a game called Seymour. Well, I was looking at the Wild West. Seymour was the game I was looking for. And this was, Seymour was an offshoot of the character we're going to be talking about, Dizzy. And they just wanted to just have another one. So, you know, just test the waters, see if they could have another character. So they brought out this other one. I also loved this guy's games, so I was going to buy one. And that day when I figured out I could afford games myself, that was the last day I ever saw a game for that price. After that was 1993. The ZX Spectrum died that year. I'm sure it was already no longer under production, but its last Games magazine closed then. And that was it. From then on, games were at least £10 and at most, you know, 70. And that was it. I could never, until, you know, I was an older teenager, I could never buy my own games. What a shame. That was a much longer ramble than I started it. Sorry about that, listeners.
But now I know about Wild West Seymour.
Yeah. So, where should we go first? Should we go Showbiz Pizza or should we go Dizzy?
Oh boy. So what's your Showbiz Pizza connection?
So here it is. Showbiz Pizza did not exist in the UK.
No.
But I am and have always been a huge fan of the automated thing of animatronics, as we now call them, but like anything like that, I've always been a huge fan. So, you know, there, if only we had a video camera, which we didn't, there would be footage of me aged 2-3 around there staring up enraptured by an animatronic band at a UK theme park. And that's the thing. You had to go to theme parks in the UK to see animatronics at all. You didn't see them in... There was no Showbiz Pizza. There was no Chuck E. Cheese. We didn't have anything like that. The most you could hope to see was in the front window of a cobbler's shop. You might see the little man with a little hammer banging a shoe. You know.
Yeah.
The simplest single hinge animated figure. That was it. But if you went to theme parks, you could see rudimentary animatronic, not nowhere near the level that you even had on the opening day of Disneyland, but sort of sub that, but still fascinating, because the jankier they are, the more they are, you know, what you might describe as a robot,
and yes,
that is really cool to me. So I mean, certainly there was a thing you would sometimes see in theme parks, which I'm sure you've got in America as well, where it's like a shooting range.
Yeah.
You're like looking into a shack full of like redneck type caricatures, and if you shoot the little targets, they do stuff. Do you have those?
Right. Oh, we do. Well, I think we used to have one at the Mall of America.
Right. Okay. Well, you had to go to theme parks to get them here. But so that stuff. Oh, I loved that stuff. And steam organs. Have you ever seen a steam organ?
Yes. I believe they have them at the House on the Rock in Wisconsin.
Awesome. What's that?
The House on the Rock? It's a tourist attraction that a man started building decades ago on a rock in Wisconsin, has expanded into multiple buildings and rooms, but it's set up so that you never know. You take a long walk. It takes you a day to go through the whole thing. You walk through doors and suddenly you are underground, but you're in a village. Like, it looks like you're in a main street of a village, and you walk into another door and you're in a giant cavernous area with a huge sperm whale fighting a squid. You walk to another door and there's the world's largest carousel. Like, it goes on forever, and it is one of the most confoundingly overwhelming things. Just Google House on the Rock and you will get 1 trillionth of just what a confounding tourist attraction it is. But yes, steam organs.
Okay, well, what you have just described is exactly the sort of thing that I'm into. That. And in fact, we have one, and yes, I'm looking at the House on the Rock now, and yes, it's the sort of thing. We have a couple of these, and one of them, the one that's closest to what you've just described, is a castle, and it is a real castle. It's not a very historic castle. It's not like an ancient castle. It was just a stately home, but it's a castle, and it was bought by an eccentric genius in the mid-70s who had a similar idea. Maybe he'd even been to this House on the Rock. He had a similar concept. And he and his family, who still live there and operate it now, filled it with that sort of thing. And when you said, you know, you walk through a door and you're underground, it was the robots were set up in the dungeon of this castle, which was turned into a labyrinth. It was absolutely brilliant. And they had these steam organs. And also in there's a place called Thursford, which has the Thursford Collection, which is just a giant hangar, essentially, full of these old steam organs, just by themselves, just freestanding steam organs. Anyone who's listening who doesn't know what we're talking about, these are the sort that the sound that an old carousel makes, that is, you know, the music that they play, that interesting jangly pipey sort of sound, that's because a steam organ would be built into the central column of these things. But also you would find them not built into carousels. They would just be a big unit that would be wheeled into ballrooms and piers, you know, like the pier over the sea, at the seaside, things like that. And what they were was basically just a giant construction filled with pipes, organ pipes and calliope pipes. But sometimes they would have saxophones built into them. They would have accordions built into them, drum kits, anything that can be operated by pumping blasts of air through. So you can, you know, so any wind instrument, but also, you know, depending on the complexity of the mechanism, I've seen a steam-operated banjo, I've seen a steam-operated violin. There was, and usually these were just like just attractions. They were just like, check it out, look what we made, you know, kind of like a player piano. You know, isn't it interesting that we can make this piano play itself by the operation of this reel of paper? And I'm sure you've all seen the kind of paper that goes through those with notches cut in certain sequences to activate the air in certain sequences, that's what plays the tune. Well, that's what these steam organs operate on, except in an incredibly increased complexity, so that a whole miniature orchestra is playing itself. These are the sorts of things that absolutely amazed me. And so an animatronics goes into that category, as far as I'm concerned, especially the tankier ones. Well,
I'm listening to this and I'm like, oh my gosh, you have to go to the House on the Rock.
Yeah, clearly.
You have to go to this. There's an entire room of just organs.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, it sounds like exactly my sort of thing.
There's like, there are so many self-playing orchestras with little robots playing all the instruments in an orchestra.
Yep, they've got the one with the robots. I've seen that in two different places. I've seen that in a...
Well, it's such a weird place. It's where Neil Gaiman set, like, the hub of American Gods was set in the House on the Rock.
If anyone had ever told me that, I would be a Gaiman fan by now, and it hasn't happened to me. I would have run to read that book, because one of my favorite books is The Night Circus, which is a recent book by Erin Morgenstern, and it was her first book. And if you've ever read that, it is about this mysterious circus that just appears, but not the creepy kind of circus. It's like this dreamlike, beautiful, yes, haunted, but in the good way, kind of place where you're always on the edge of wondering if what you're looking at is magic or just performance art. And it opens at night, and they never tell anyone that they're going to be there, and people just gradually find out about it. And over the course of the book, this place, well, it keeps appearing in different places. They'll just suddenly pack up and move on. And there are fans of this circus who start to figure out where it is and look for clues, and they all dress a certain way to, like, indicate to each other that they're members of this club. And reading it, it's the only time anyone has ever been able to explain what I've been trying to explain all my life about this castle that I went to as a kid. And you may have noticed I haven't named the castle. And that's because I'm just not ready to. I've been trying to figure out for years how I'm going to explain this, and like whether I'll make a video, whether I'll like write an entire book. Like, what will it be to show my audience this amazing place? Because you can't just go there, because if you do, you'll be like, oh, this is just a family day out, this is just normal. You have to experience it through the eyes of this, you know, 2 to 8 year old kid that I was, who kept going back to this weird place. But it does sound exactly like the vibe that's, you know, that you're describing with this other place. Exactly. So anyway, so they had animatronics there.
And, yes.
Well, so I was into them because of that, but you had to go to that sort of place to see any animatronic in the UK. And then one day, we went to stay in Yorkshire, and we went to a theme park there called Flamingo Land. Now, you'll find that theme parks in the UK have weird names like that. The biggest theme park in the whole country is called Alton Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And if that sounds like a sort of an old stately home type mansion, that's because it is. It's a real one. It's not like themed around a mansion. It actually is one. And whoever lives there, and I genuinely don't know, just leased the grounds because they were so extensive, and allowed a small park to be built there. And over the years, that has grown into the leading theme park in the country. Like with Disneyland, its rides are famous and people know their names. Nemesis,
yeah.
Stuff like that. Alton Towers, Drayton Manor is another one. Same story. When I was a kid, that was Drayton Manor Park and Zoo. But now it's just Drayton Manor because it's, again, a great big theme park. Which, by the way, when we get out of quarantine, I recommend, because it's just about as good as Alton Towers, but nobody knows, so it's usually not packed. So it's like, you know, that's a good one to go to. That's the sort of name of the sort of place that we have. And Flamingo Land, I can only imagine, started as a zoo. There's one. Here's another one. The Milky Way. That is another theme park, right? I think for younger kids, but I don't know. It could just be a normal theme park. When I went to the Milky Way in the early 90s, it was just a sort of a farm museum. That's why it's called the Milky Way. But it had play area in the middle of it, and now they've got rides. And, you know, that's how these things happen. Well, Flamingo Land, which must once have been a zoo, or some sort of safari park, I don't know what it was.
It was the Yorkshire Zoological Gardens.
There we go. Well, that, by the time I went, was a full-on theme park. And as you were entering this theme park, one of the first things you see was a gift shop. And it had these little badges with this little cartoon bear on. And it says, I'm a friend of Billy Bob Bear. And Billy Bob Bear is, of course...
Of course.
Is it a banjo he's playing or a little guitar? Whatever it is he's playing.
A banjo,
yeah. He's the guy, anyway, from the Rockafire Explosion, the animatronic band from Showbiz Pizza. But I know it from this one theme park. So
crazy.
The context for it in America, of course, is that it was a chain of pizza restaurants that had an animatronic band and kids were supposed to be enthralled by this. Well, I'd already experienced that at another theme park connected to and run by the people from my magic castle, where as you were eating your donuts or gingerbread men or whatever you could convince your kids to eat, a curtain would draw across right next to your table, because this was only about three tables in this area. It was a very, very small little area. But they had a full scale, or at least on the scale of like the central stage of the Rocket Fire explosion, animatronic band who would, and I don't even know how they did this in retrospect, because I remember that it sort of was up next to a ball pit and sort of play area. Somehow they would have characters actually moving in from the sides, from off stage, coming in, and you know, they must have come from behind and then turned round on a bit of track just there or something. But it, like large props, it was based around the concept of, what are they called? You know, in cartoons and old films, there'll always be a gag where two people, or if he's unlucky, one person, will get stuck on a little trundly trolley that's on a piece of rail track, and the people operating it have to push a sort of seesaw handle together.
Yeah.
You know those things? What are those things?
I think, I want to say hand car.
Yeah?
I think it's a hand car. I was actually looking this up yesterday, and I think it's a hand car, but I can't. I was actually looking it up in reverse because someone mentioned there's a term for it that I can't think of, but I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So the two characters come on stage on one of these, and one of them's a pig, and the other one's a... No, one's a fox, and the other one's a beaver. But then a pig comes along driving a train or something, or like... and he's... there's four characters all in all that come in, they just sing songs and do little sketches and things. It was absolutely brilliant. And it's just gone now. It's just gone. Because that place has closed down. It's been demolished. I imagine that the whole thing has been like put in a storage container somewhere. It must exist somewhere. But that's gone. It's such a shame. And anyway, so I was already familiar with the concept of the animatronic band. And then you're going through this theme park and you reach this area called Billy Bob's Land or Billy Bob's World or something. And it's just this sort of corner of the theme park with some no particularly strong theme, just some rides and an ice cream stall and things like that. But there are this bear's face on everything. It's just, they've just bought the branding for this thing. And the highlight attraction of this area is a theater. And you go in and it is not a pizza restaurant. And that's not what I think of as the home of the Rocket Fire explosion. It was literally a theatre built specially for this. So it was an enclosed environment, lights off. The only lights were the stage lights. So you're going in, there's, you know, curtains drawn across this stage with the caricature. Same stage, so it's got the caricatures of the characters along the top. Your Beach Bear and Mitzi and Duke and all these. And you sit in seats, not around pizza tables, just literally an audience, just seats. And now the interesting thing is that when I first went in, the curtain was broken. So as we went in, the curtain was not drawn, or it was drawn, whichever one it is that means it was open.
Right.
So we were seeing these static characters sitting there. And as I'm sure you'll know, they're big. There's a real visceral physicality to these characters when those curtains open. And let me tell you, that is only increased by them being dead. You just walk in this room and there are these giant statues. And it's called the Rock of Fire Explosion. You don't know what that means. And so me and my little brother were sort of like, is this going to be like a nightmare? Is this going to be too much? Well, because if you're the sort of kid who, you know, grows up loving this sort of thing, you do have nightmares about them coming to life. You know,
of course.
This is genuinely true. When Five Nights at Freddy's first came out, my wife is into watching, you know, Let's Plays of scary games. And so she was like, Dave, there's a new scary game that you've got to see. And I'm like, I don't like watching Let's Plays and things. So I'm like, yeah, really? And she's like, no, Dave. It's like this scary game was made specifically with you in mind. And I said, and I swear this is true, I said, oh, what? Is it about, like, creepy animatronics in a showbiz pizza coming to life? And she's like, yes, Dave, that is what it's like. So there we are going into this theatre, and we're like, what's going to happen? I remember having the visceral idea of them, they're about to, like, hurt each other because of the word explosion in the title. I thought they were going to like be throwing, you know, bombs at each other and stuff, and there'd be these big explosions going off. So, but anyway, that. But I could not have anticipated what I was about to see. I thought I was going to see, you know, a bit of rocking back and forth, maybe a mouth circling open, closed, but first the lights went dark, and then the tape started up, and there was this loud hissing. And I now think that that hissing was, you know, the you know, them letting the air into the mechanism. But at the time,
yeah,
I thought it was that they'd started the tape, you know, the audio that was going to play.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that they had turned it up way too loud. And I actually still think it might have been that, because I was a tapes kid. I was really, really into tapes. I still have my tapes from when I was a kid. And it's like, it takes up, you know, half of Under the Bed. It's huge collection. And I think I would have recognized the difference between the sound of air going through pipes with the sound of a tape being switched on too loud. So I actually do still think that was what I heard. And so I was scared. And then the lights came on and the air did start pumping through and they moved, they came to life. And if you've never seen the Rockafire explosion, or even if you have seen it but only on YouTube, God, they were amazing. There's still nothing as accomplished as that, even at Disneyland now. Yeah, they've got like better skin over the, and, you know, they hide the joints better, but the actual movement was incredible. These characters, and there was altogether about six or seven of them on stage all at once, and they were just so intricately puppeteered. Like, their arms, their faces had multiple joints on them. They were turning to look at each other. But the real icing on the cake, and this you don't get anymore, because Aaron, whatever his name is, who made these things, he is still now, you know, making new songs and programs and putting them on, and you can watch them move on YouTube. But it doesn't have the spark that they had then, because what they had back then was, now it's all Aaron doing the voices of most of these characters. But at the time, each character was voiced by a different person, and they actually recorded in a single room together live. And they did play the music, and they were a band. And so what they have is this genuine reality to their banter. You can tell they've got scripted jokes, and a lot of it is scripted, but sometimes they'll have conversations that, like, it's one of the most, like, naturalistic performances you'll ever see. If you can find the original programs, like the actual old recordings, it's so weird. I genuinely can't tell where improvisation ends and just good acting begins. Because some of it, you know, they're like responding properly, realistically, to bad jokes that they're telling that are obviously scripted, but they're groaning in a realistic way. They're having little banter back and forth. It was so naturalistic. And then on top of that, these giant robots. But I mean, I don't know how big they really were, but they were certainly bigger physically than I was. And I think,
bigger than a child, yeah.
I think bigger than an adult. They were like, if they were to, you know, if you put an adult next to them, I think they'd be probably about the same height. But because they've got, you know, big animal heads and, you know, heightened physicality, I think they're bigger than a person, but I can't swear to that. But those things, doing that realistic acting and banter, God, you got so attached to them as people. I was obsessed with them. Just, I used to draw comics of them. Me and my brother used to sing songs about them on the beach on that holiday that we were on in Yorkshire. Like, it was incredible. And that is that's half of my experience with them. And then, three short years later, from 1993 to the summer of 1996, we went back to Flamingoland, and they still had it, but it was just ruined. The theater didn't, it now did serve pizza, and that actually made it worse. I don't know why, but that annoyed me, because it used to be a theater experience.
Right.
Now it was
like Country Bear Jamboree.
Exactly. Now it was just another cafe in the theme park, but this one happened to have this. Nobody was paying attention anymore to the show, and that annoyed me, you know, because they were talking over it, and I could. But also, there was like, the doors were left open, so the sunlight was always streaming in, so there was no theatrical feel to it at all. They were just these waggling puppets now, and What's more, bits of them were broken. One of Fats the Gorilla's eyes was popped in. His head only, like, one of the pistons was gone. So every movement his head did translated to the same movement. So he was always just jerking his head round to the left. And it just looked, it was rubbish. Some of their mouths didn't work properly. Some of their hands didn't work properly. It just hadn't been maintained. Because, of course,
to
get it maintained, you have to get this one guy to fly over. So,
right.
So, you know, Aaron, whatever his name was. So he would have, flown in to personally install it the first time round. He would have been there. And then that was it. He wouldn't have been back. And so it had just gone to rack and ruin. And I remember a couple of years later than that, when I was first with now my wife, Abby, we were teenagers and she was coming on these family holidays with us, and we went to Yorkshire. And I was like, oh, I could show her the Rock of Fire explosion. So I phoned them up and I said to the girl on the desk, I said, hello, this is a funny question, but I'm just wondering, I don't know how I phoned them up. This would have been in the first years of mobile phones. Maybe we had a mobile phone, but anyway, I phoned them up. Well, not the Zach Morris first years, but the years when there were first things people had. Anyway, funny question. I'd like to know if you still have the Rock of Fire Explode, the Billy Bob show. If you still have the Billy Bob show, because that's what they called it there. And if so, like, how is it? Like, is it in good nick? Has it been restored? Because it was a bit broken last time I saw it. And she went, oh, I don't know. I'll go and find out. And she went away. And I was like, well, that doesn't bode well. She's never...
No, it doesn't.
One of the main attractions of this place. She's never heard of it. She went away. And ages later, like, you know, at least 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, it took her ages. She finally came back and she said, yes, we do still have that attraction. And I was like, no, I'm not bothering with this. Clearly, that is something they don't care about.
So you didn't go see it?
That time, no. So Abby never saw it. And until, of course, the... that'll tell a lie. We actually had a VHS tape that we bought in 1990. Must have been 3.
As you did.
Yeah, because we actually went 2 years running, to 92 and 93 we went. And so I think it was in 93... They had a video you could buy of that theme park for £11, and and it just had like clips of everything they had at the theme park. So, you know, half of it is like just like other people's kids on swings and stuff. Like, don't care about this. But there's what must be all of 15 seconds of footage of the Rock of Fire explosion. And I used to just watch this over and over and over again. Because it's in perfect working order, it might still be one of the best videos there exists of the Rock of Fire explosion. I can digitize VHS now, so I'll have to go and get it and from my parents' house and get that digitized.
The last time I saw the Rock of Fire explosion perform was they had a Chuck E. Cheese's set up here, because by this point they were the same company. It was one of the same, and I went with the woman I was dating. We're like, this will be fun. Yeah. Let's go see the band perform. We haven't seen this since we were kids. And all I remember is that no kids were interested in watching this band.
Oh, no.
And that Mitzi Mozzarella was broken.
Oh.
Meaning her neck was broken, so her head was just lolling to one side.
Oh no.
But she had a solo. She sang Girls Just Wanna Have Fun.
Yeah.
And so the robot turned, like the spotlight went on her, but her neck was busted. And then halfway through the song, she just turned up stage. And so it was like this ghoul singing the song, Girls Just Want to Have Fun. It didn't know where it was. And it was a very disheartening experience.
That is why they aren't remembered as being scary. But they are, aren't they? Like, they're always, whenever you hear about these, I mean, Five Nights at Freddy's is obviously the greatest example of that. But, like, before that, there was a Simpsons sketch watching it as a kid, I didn't realize they were talking about anything that really existed. I thought they were depicting the pizza planet of the Simpsons, like the dream, the dream restaurant, the best place possibly. Because I still can't believe that those things just existed in normal towns. Like, not in Disneyland, just in a town you could go to a place that had those.
It's in your strip mall.
Yeah. That's incredible to me. Absolutely incredible.
You would go to birthday parties at Showbiz, and then Billy Bob, the animatronic, would be like, "Why, here we have a birthday boy here today."
Yeah.
And they'd be like, "Hey there, Jimmy, come on up."
Yeah.
And there would be someone doing the voice, I guess, like who worked there. And the kid would have to go stand before the animatronic.
I would love to have stood next to that thing.
And you weren't allowed next to it because it was on a raised platform.
Yeah.
So you stood below it. Okay. Like it there was a pecking order, and the thing would sing happy birthday, and then the bird would pop up out of the stump and sing along with it. And it was like this thing of honor. Like, yes, like if you were lucky enough to have a birthday at Showbiz Pizza, like you got called up by Billy Bob and were addressed in front of the crowd.
I would love that so much.
And again, like to a kid, like there wasn't, it was you know, you knew that all the kids around you were from your area, and it was a little bit of honor, like for a local child.
Yeah.
But it's funny because like Showbiz was ubiquitous. It was this, and of course I grew up in Texas where like I think Showbiz and Chuck E. Cheese, I think they started in the south of in the South U.S. Yeah. So we were kind of testing grounds for a lot of that. But we haven't gotten to Dizzy yet.
Okay, yeah. Just before we finish on Showbiz, I've just heard recently that having purchased Showbiz Pizza, or at least, you know, folded into it, Chuck E. Cheese, already having removed all the... There's no rocket fire explosions anymore. It's Chuck E. Cheese now. And I think it was last year that they finally made the decision that there's not going to be any animatronics at Chuck E. Cheese anymore.
And, yeah, they pulled all that.
And that's just... disgusting to me, because and of course there's the nostalgic in me. Like, I'm still annoyed that McDonald's isn't a sort of miniature theme park itself anymore. Like, the appeal of McDonald's used to be that it had like characters that were from that place, so you went there and you got a Happy Meal and you got a toy fry guy in it or whatever, like characters you knew from the TV adverts and the tie-in stuff. Now it is just a place where you eat burgers, and it's like, well, I don't want to then. Bring back the fun. You used to be able to sit on spotted toadstools, and like, there was little, like, it was nice. In the same way, in a much deeper way, it actually genuinely disgusts me that what they've done at Chuck E. Cheese, because that is an art form that doesn't exist now. Because that company, it genuinely is similar to when Disney burned all the 2D animation desks. It's just like, that's a thing that we can't really show our kids. You know, we can't, like, with a NES, you know, your kids might not be interested, but you can show it to them. But with the Rocket Fire explosion, you know, I don't want to go around Chris Thrash's house to see it. Or like, is that his name? There's a guy who built one in his garage, I think he actually ended up having to get rid of that. But like, you don't want to have to go to a private collector, and you can't anyway because it's theirs. But
yeah,
that whole genre being shut down, there is now no such thing as the animatronic band. Like, I never got to see one, and I never got to see a pizza restaurant with an animatronic band, and it's just, that disgusts me. Don't do that. Make them better.
See, you would have loved the original Chuck E. Cheese, which I experienced as a very small child when they first showed up, because the original Chuck E. Cheese did not have a stage band. It had a balcony band that leaned over a balcony above you.
It was just
animatronics from the waist up, but it was also a very dark restaurant. Like, the whole restaurant was dark, and it was sectioned off into rooms. So like, one room had like an animatronic cow at a keyboard or something, and you would just walk past it and push a button and it would do its show. And one room was just a strobe light room.
Ooh.
That you would enter, and the walls were mirrors, and you would turn on the strobe light and just walk into the walls. Like, that was it.
You're absolutely speaking my language here. This is exactly the stuff. I don't know why they don't make this kind of thing anymore.
Because it was dangerous, and Very difficult to maintain. Also very filthy, if I remember correct. But it was fast. Like,
okay,
it was,
but a lot of that stuff is not necessary to the genre. Like, it does. It could.
No.
They could clean it, and they could turn the lights on to make it less dangerous.
But I think it speaks to the notion of, like, these were sort of like generally accessible entertainments that were sort of manufactured and put together by a very small group of people.
Yeah.
So it was this very singular vision of, like, here's what we think families will like. Here's what, this hasn't been group tested. It hasn't been beta tested. It's just, we hammered this together.
Yeah.
We recorded our songs. I hope you're entertained. And
yeah,
enough people showed up and they were like, you know what? This is weird. But it's very niche, but it's there's enough of a populist feel to it that sure, whole families can enjoy this. Kids, you like watching the robot monsters on stage singing pop songs. Let's eat some pizza and have a good time. And it doesn't have to feel like Disney World. It doesn't have to feel like, you know, like the mall. It can feel like its own thing.
Yeah.
It's a weird pizza place where this is the only place you can do this one thing.
Yeah.
It's at this one location.
Yeah. It's amazing. Bring them back. That's if I ever, like, won the lottery and became a multi-millionaire, there would be one of them. There would be a new one of them for everybody to come and see, for sure.
If this podcast does nothing, let it bring back the animatronic stage show.
Yes. Why not? Like, what's the problem?
Yeah.
It's so weird. In the 19... Well, certainly 80s, but probably 70s, they invented robots. And now we just don't want them?
We don't want the robots anymore.
Of course we want robots. It's ridiculous that you can't... Anyway, there we go. Showbiz pizza, line under that.
Yeah.
Now I'll tell you about Dizzy.
Yeah, what about Dizzy? Well, if you want to find out what Dave has to say about Dizzy, who is Dizzy, and how he came to know Dizzy, tune in for part two of this interview next week, my interview with Dave Ballmer. If you want to find more about Dave, you can find him on YouTube or Twitter at Demon Tomato Dave. Check out his podcasts, Sonic the Comic, the podcast, or Serious Dizziness. They're both wonderful. You can find me at BerensteinBearcast.com. You can find me on Patreon at patreon.com/deepinbearcountry, or you can write to me at berensteinbearcast@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you, and I will see you all next time deep in bear country.